to thank Virginia in particular for the invitation to speak on this panel. And I also want to recognize that this is the work of my institution and my colleagues and does not reflect my own work. But I will be happy to answer any questions that you have at the end of the session. Let's see here. Women everywhere are sexually assaulted, and their attackers enjoy impunity. Sexual violence against women happens at an alarming rate, as we all know, in times of peace and during armed conflict. In the context of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, these brutal attacks can also be deadly. Often, women are silenced by the stigma attached to sexual violence, but increasingly they are speaking out and demanding accountability for these crimes. Police and other law enforcement authorities are quick to dismiss rape and other forms of sexual violence as unimportant crimes provoked by the victims themselves. Under international law, however, governments have a duty to respond effectively to violence against women, including rape, in times of peace and during war. Thank you to my assistant for the slide turning. Several critical factors make sexual violence and conflict resistant to eradication. First, women's subordinate and unequal status in peacetime renders them predictably at risk for sexual violence in times of war. Second, increasing international exposure and public outrage about rape in conflict have failed to translate into vigorous investigation and prosecution of perpetrators, a necessary element in any serious effort to deter such violence. Finally, inadequate services for survivors of wartime sexual assault reflect official disregard for the harm women and girls suffer in the course of conflict and suggest a lack of commitment to facilitating rape survivors' reintegration into society. Sexual violence against women and girls, both inside and outside conflict, has a long history. Mass rape of women and girls was documented during World War II, as well as in more recent conflicts in the former Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Sexual violence has often in the past been considered as an inevitable byproduct of armed conflict and has been mischaracterized by military and political leaders as a private crime or the unfortunate behavior of renegade soldiers. Rape is increasingly recognized, however, as a weapon of war, meaning that it is not a private or incidental crime. Rape as a weapon of war serves a strategic function and acts as an integral tool for achieving military and political objectives, not merely an act of violence that targets sexuality. It functions to subjugate and humiliate both the women and men within the targeted community. Furthermore, rape is generally not committed in isolation, and victims are often subjected to multiple human rights abuses, which serve to further traumatize them. In conflicts in which civilians are the principal targets, sexual violence has become an even more deliberate and insidious weapon of war. International law has prohibited rape and other forms of sexual violence against women during armed conflict for over a century. International humanitarian law, also known as the laws of war, sets out protections for civilians, prisoners of war, and other non-combatants during international and internal armed conflicts. Depending on the broader context within which the crimes are committed, perpetrators can be held accountable for rape and other forms of sexual violence as war crimes, crimes against humanity, and acts of genocide. The four Geneva Conventions and their two additional protocols implicitly and explicitly condemn rape as well as other forms of sexual violence as serious violations of humanitarian law in both international and internal conflicts. I'm just going to mention a few of these as well, and I'll be happy to answer more questions about them later. Unlike war crimes, crimes against humanity may be committed in times of peace or in periods of unrest that do not rise to the level of an armed conflict. The definition and prohibition on crimes against humanity has been incorporated into a number of international treaties and statutes of international criminal tribunals, including the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. There is no single international treaty that provides an authoritative definition of crimes against humanity, but such crimes are generally considered to be serious and inhumane acts committed as part of a widespread attack against the civilian population during peacetime or during war. The statutes of both the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the Tribunal for Rwanda make explicit mention of rape when committed as part of a widespread attack against the civilian population as a crime against humanity. Both of those tribunals that I mentioned have played a critical role in setting precedents in the prosecution of conflict-related sexual violence, including articulating definitions and elements of many gender-related crimes. The statute of the International Criminal Court also explicitly identifies the acts of rape, sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, forced pregnancy, enforced sterilization, or any other form of sexual violence of comparable gravity as acts that can be crimes against humanity. Crimes against humanity, as serious international crimes, may also be subject to universal jurisdiction. And this is the part I think is interesting. Meaning that national courts can be given jurisdiction to try a person suspected of a crime against humanity, even if neither the suspect nor the victim are nationals of the country where that court is located, and even if the crime took place outside that country. Rape and sexual violence can also be considered, obviously, a form of torture. The international human rights instruments provide safeguards for women and girls at all times. These include protection from rape and sexual assault as forms of torture or other prohibited ill treatment, slavery, forced prostitution, and discrimination based on sex. Armed opposition groups, particularly those in control of territory, have increasingly been under obligation to respect international human rights standards. For example, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhumane, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, and other regional charters, including one of the African charters, all prohibit torture and degrading treatment by officials or persons acting in an official capacity. The Convention on the Rights of the Child provides for the right to freedom from torture, from sexual exploitation and abuse, as well as liberty and security of the person. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture has recognized that rape can constitute torture, as have the international criminal tribunals in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. Sexual violence generally violates women's rights to be free from discrimination based on sex, as provided for under the Covenant for Civil and Political Rights. Under Article 1 of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW as we know it, the definition of discrimination is considered to include gender-based violence precisely because gender-based violence has the effect or purpose of impairing or nullifying the enjoyment of women of their human rights on a basis of equality with men. The CEDAW Committee enumerated a wide range of obligations for states related to ending sexual violence, including ensuring appropriate treatment for victims in the justice system, counseling, support services, medical treatment, and psychological assistance. As you can see on the slide, too, I also have some of the other language from some of the other conventions, which I won't mention in detail here. Individual acts of rape or other sexual assault can be prosecuted as criminal acts. However, an individual case of serious sexual violence can also be prosecuted as a crime against humanity if the crime was committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack against the civilian population. Each enumerated type of act, such as murder, torture, or rape, does not need to be committed on a widespread or systematic basis. It is the attack that must be widespread or systematic. Since we talk a lot about justice in the human rights community and we address violations of human rights, that's one of the reasons why I'm focusing a lot on these international laws and obligations and some of the criminality aspects of it. Individual criminal responsibility for a crime or for a serious violation of human rights or international humanitarian law can be established when an accused is proved to have either planned, instigated, ordered, committed, or otherwise aided or abetted in the commission of the crime. Superior officers may also be liable for crimes committed by their subordinates on the basis of command responsibility. Although the concept of command responsibility originated in military law, it now embraces the responsibility of civil authorities for the abuses committed by those persons under their effective authority. Both state and non-state actors, such as commanders of armed rebel groups, can be held accountable on the basis of command responsibility for crimes against humanity. Under the doctrine of command responsibility, commanders or other superiors may be culpable for failing to prevent or punish crimes committed by their subordinates when the superior knew or had reason to know that the criminal acts were about to be committed or had been committed, and when that superior failed to take necessary and reasonable measures to prevent the commission of that offense or to punish the perpetrators. A commander will therefore be found guilty of rape if he or she stood by while the subordinate committed rape. All of these I mentioned because they are played out in the sort of work that Human Rights Watch does, both within the Women's Rights Division and across divisions. Listed here are some of the countries where work on sexual violence has taken place. I'm going to briefly cite some examples from the first four countries, but if you'll have a look on our website, you'll find a lot of other information regarding other countries as well. One of the most recent reports came out just this year, and the title is My Heart is Cut, Sexual Violence by Rebels and Pro-Government Forces in Cote d'Ivoire. Armed conflict erupted in Cote d'Ivoire in 2002, resulting in brutal forms of sexual violence against women and girls by armed men on both sides of the military and political divide. Human Rights Watch documented over 180 cases of sexual violence in Cote d'Ivoire, including individual and gang rape, sexual slavery, forced incest, and egregious sexual assault. Some rape victims died because of the sexual violence inflicted against them. Many who did survive were raped so violently that they suffered serious bleeding, tearing in the genital area, long-term incontinence, and severe infections. While some pregnant women miscarried and other women became infertile as a result of the sexual violence they endured, yet others experienced the trauma of unwanted pregnancies resulting from rape. The women whom we interviewed, whom my colleagues interviewed, suffered psychologically as well as physically. They told Human Rights Watch of their anguish, shame, rage, and depression, as well as their courage in the face of unimaginable suffering. Determining the full extent of the problem of sexual violence is complicated by difficulties in documenting them, which arises from the fear of reprisals, the authorities' lack of concern, and tremendous security risks associated with reporting or investigating those crimes. Underreporting poses an additional problem and partly reflects the low status of women and girls in Cote d'Ivoire, the cultural taboos around the issues of sexual violence, and women's fear of rejection by family and community. International human rights and humanitarian law requires that the Ivorian authorities put an immediate end to impunity for perpetrators and to provide adequate services for the survivors. Since we're also in a public health conference and reflecting a lot on health issues, I wanted to point out some of the importance of health services in Cote d'Ivoire, because it's very valuable to address impunity on both the domestic and international front, but justice alone cannot alleviate the suffering of the survivors. Therefore, the new forces, the government, and aid agencies in Cote d'Ivoire must improve the medical assistance, provide free medical certificates to rape victims, launch a nationwide information campaign on the connection between sexual violence and HIV/AIDS, and that means on prevention, counseling, testing, and treatment, and prioritize the nationwide establishment of sexual and reproductive health programs for women and girls. Ivorian women should be active participants in the formulation and the implementation of these programs. Darfur and the surrounding regions of Chad have received a lot of publicity in recent years, although the situation of genocide has not changed as drastically as one would have hoped, given the urgent appeals and some of the mobilization around this topic. I think most of us in the room know many of the reasons why these attacks happen, why women are afraid to leave their temporary dwellings to even look for firewood because of rape and sexual violence. Therefore, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, other than to say that Human Rights Watch has issued many statements on the situation over the last few years, have made visits, and the highest level of UN personnel have been involved in trying to stop the systematic violence, rape, and killing. The UN Security Council in 2005 referred to the situation in Darfur to the International Criminal Court. When serious sexual violence forms part of a widespread or systematic attack against civilians, it can constitute a crime against humanity. In the case of Darfur, such crimes could be prosecuted under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. And these are just some comments of the director of the Africa Division in Human Rights Watch about the need for donors to set up programs to protect women and girls from the sexual violence and address the needs of those who've been raped, and that the African Union UN mission needs to be prepared to protect civilians, and peacekeepers in Darfur need to have the capacity to respond rapidly to these kinds of threats. Since Virginia has given us the luxury of extending this a little bit with just three people, I ask my panel's permission also to just delve into a few more examples here, and one of them is in the Democratic Republic of Congo. During 5 years of armed conflict in the DRC, tens of thousands of women and girls in the eastern part of the country have suffered crimes. The signing of the peace agreement in 2002 and the installation of a transitional government in 2003 raised hopes that both the military conflict and the related abuses would end. But in eastern Congo, women and girls, as young as 3 years old, continue to be targeted for crimes of sexual violence. Some have been gang raped or abducted by combatants for long periods of sexual slavery. Some have been mutilated or gravely injured by having objects inserted into their vaginas. Some who fought back when attacked have been killed. In a number of cases, men and boys have also become victims of sexual violence. The perpetrators of the sexual violence are members of all the armed forces that operate in eastern Congo, as is detailed in the Human Rights Watch report, for those of you who are interested in more detail. Victims of crime and sexual violence have enormous needs for medical, psychological, and social support. And unless such needs are met, they have difficulty beginning and persevering in efforts to bring those perpetrators of crime to justice. Congolese NGOs were the first to assist the victims, and growing support now comes from various international agencies and international NGOs. Among the services now offered in a few communities are assistance in initiating legal action against those suspected to be responsible for sexual violence. Just in the last few weeks, the International Criminal Court did issue an arrest warrant for one of the military leaders, Katanga, for war crimes, including sexual enslavement. And it has been documented that Katanga ordered, tolerated, or personally committed ethnic massacres, murder, torture, rape, mutilation, and recruitment of child soldiers. So this is one example of an attempt at bringing at least one of the perpetrators to justice. I'm also actually not going to go into this, just bare little time, but I also wanted to mention that there's also a report, a very interesting report on violence against Palestinian women and girls in situations of conflict. So not exactly war, but in situations of conflict. And there's a lot of interesting documentation there about what the Palestinian Authority has the right to do, as they have signed on, not as a state, but they have publicly announced their intention to abide by international human rights laws and standards, and also what Israel has the right to permit, or at least not to obstruct. And I just wanted to point out here that Israel does have responsibilities for the implementation of international human rights treaties that it's ratified in areas under its control, such as the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israel should not undermine the ability of Palestinian judges, police officers, forensic doctors, lawyers, and social service providers to move within and between the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel in order to carry out their job or undertake training. In conclusion, one of the greatest challenges is to prevent sexual violence against women in the first case. This can be achieved by making concerted efforts in at least three arenas. First, there must be heightened respect for women's human rights in all aspects of their lives. Failure to address sex discrimination as a significant underlying cause of sexual violence will ensure that present and future generations of women continue to be at risk for sexual violence. Second, there must be significantly improved compliance with the provisions of international humanitarian law during armed conflicts. Key methods include regular training and education of soldiers and other combatants regarding international legal protections for civilians, specifically prohibitions against rape and other forms of gender-based violence. Finally, there must be vigorous condemnation, investigation, and prosecution of gender-specific crimes against women in times of peace as well as in war. Thank you.